Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. I am joined by my friend and colleague, Rabbi Oran Zweider. And today we're going to be discussing Rav Israel Hildesheimer and Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer's exchange about a debate that took place in, well, I guess you could say early America, depending on your understanding of early America. Rabbi Zweider will fill us in on that in just a moment, about a controversy that brewed about giving a bris to children of non-Jewish mothers, but they have Jewish fathers, and all the halachic and political and social implications of that. So definitely a very exciting topic. But before we jump in, let us just get to know our guest, Rabbi Zweider, who's with us. So Rabbi Oran Zweider is the Assistant Coordinator of Judaic Studies at the Bicultural Hebrew Academy Upper School in Stamford, Connecticut. He has worked in a number of schools and shuls prior to this. He holds a master's in Talmud from the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies, and so far has completed coursework towards a PhD in American Jewish History. He has published articles on halacha and rabbinics in America. In particular, I should give a shout out to your YU Torah page, in which you have a series on tshuvos in, again, if early, you'll tell me if early America is the right way to phrase this, early-ish for Jews at least. And in particular, why Rabbi Zweider, I think, is just an excellent to have for this is that Rabbi Zweider, as we mentioned, is not only trained in rabbinics, but also is a historian by training as well. And something that I think is really remarkable about tshuva literature is that we get to know not just the halachos on the page, but we get a sense of the history and the story behind the questions that get asked. So without any further ado, Rabbi Zweider, I give the mic over to you. Can you tell us why you chose this topic and what we have to know?
All right. So, well, first of all, thank you so much, Rabbi Kurtz, for having me. It's a real pleasure and looking forward to discussing this with you. As you mentioned, one of my real interests is halacha. Particularly in, as you correctly pointed out, quote-unquote, early American Jewish history. That's obviously a relative term. The way I sort of define it, and I think this is, you know, how many also kind of see it, is that it's prior to the kind of mass immigration of Eastern Europeans to this country, which brought many more rabbis and many more capable rabbinic decisors with that wave of immigration. So question is, what was going on here prior to that? We know that there were many Jews here prior to the late 19th century when those rabbis and those that mass immigration started coming over. So that's really where a lot of my interest lies, which brings us to today's topic. I guess we'll jump in. And one of the rabbis, the first, just to give a little bit of background, the first ordained rabbi to come to this country came in 1840. His name was Rabbi Abraham Rice. So for about 200 years, there were no really ordained rabbis in this country. As I like to say, some might call it the glory years of American Jewry. So subsequent to that, a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Bernard Illouis, who we're going to discuss today, came over. He comes to the United States in 1853. He was from Bohemia, which we now consider kind of the Czech Republic, that area of the world, Central Europe. He was a Talmud. He's actually a musmach of the Chasam Sofer. So I don't know. He certainly learned in the Pressburg Yeshiva. I don't know, not exactly sure for how long, but I believe his smicha was from none other than the Chasam Sofer. He had to leave his native land, Bohemia, that area, for various political reasons. He spoke out against the government and then was therefore basically denied getting a shtel, right, getting any sort of position there. So he came to America He's a colorful figure. He first was in New York and then in Philadelphia, St. Louis. I believe he was in Syracuse, New York. The part we're going to, he ended up his last position, and that's where he's died, and he's buried in Cincinnati. But we'll talk about his time in New Orleans, which fascinatingly enough, he was a rabbi in New Orleans during the Civil War. So you can imagine what that meant. Kind of aside from the rabbinic piece, the political piece, as to what what he had to go through and deal with. Rabbi Illouis writes, and this will bring us to the topic. He writes elsewhere about the problem of intermarriage that he encountered in New Orleans, and it was. Particularly, what he was concerned about was Jewish men who were marrying non-Jewish women, it's unclear, right? I assume there are a couple of reasons for that. The pool was probably pretty small, as to eligible singles, Jewish singles back then in New Orleans, but also it certainly reflects a strong degree of assimilation. So what he's faced with, and this is the topic at hand, was, and stop me at any point, obviously, what he's faced with is these Jewish men who marry Jewish women. Oh, my light just went off. I'm sorry.
Same here.
Apologies.
You guys went green, Baruch Hashem.
What?
You guys are going green, Baruch Hashem.
Yeah, exactly. You have to like move every so often. So, in any case, so he's faced with these Jewish men who marry Jewish women. They give birth to children, and when it's a boy, so he's faced with the question that these fathers, in particular, want to give a bris. They want to circumcise their child. He doesn't really give the reason for that. Presumably, it was some connection that they wanted to maintain to their their original faith. They weren't particularly devout and firm people, but they wanted to give a bris to their children.
That's kind of funny because, sometimes, I mean, again, I'm speaking only anecdotally. Many people who I meet who are not as observant, bris is one of those things that they would sooner not want to have their child be around. So that's
Right.
pretty
So an
interesting.
interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, was, might be the prevalence of circumcision in general back then. I don't know, what that might have meant for those little boys. So interestingly enough, there were three Mo'alim practicing in New Orleans at the time. And Rabbi Illouis basically issued the following psak. He said that number one, it is forbidden to circumcise, to give a bris to these little boys. Number two is he said that any mohel that basically he says that the mohelim have to abide by his psak, that they are not allowed, right? So it wasn't just to the families, but the mohelim themselves are not allowed to practice that they're not allowed to perform the circumcision, the bris. And basically, thirdly, any mohel that does not abide by his psak is disqualified from doing mila in the future. So there were three mohelim, two listened to him, and one a fellow by the name of Goldenberg was his last name. Good Jewish name,
Sounds
right?
Jewish.
You would trust a mohel named Goldenberg, right? So
That's
he did not
trying too
abide
hard.
by. Yeah, he did not abide by Rabbi Illouis' psak. The tshuva is not like a classic tshuva that's written. Rabbi Illouis doesn't have, a book of shilos and tshuvos. Although there was a posthumously printed, a volume of his writings, which is like all good things in the world, available on HebrewBooks.org. But his tshuva basically was printed in a couple of newspapers at the time, in Jewish American newspapers. So he says, He has his reasoning for his psak is basically he says, A, it's if you're going to give a mila to these boys, so then you're basically people are going to think that they're Jewish, right? But they haven't gone through, they will not have gone through a full gerus, right? They won't do tefillah later on, presumably. And so people are going to get confused, and they're going to end up marrying Jewish women under the premise that the false premise that they are that they're Jewish. So he was concerned about that. Number two, he says it's a obviously a bracha levatala if you're going to perform a milah on them. And again, and he says, and thirdly, he says, their fathers are intermarried. Their fathers don't keep anything, and so even if they do go through a full gerus, we don't need to bring more. I think he uses this term basically chotim, right? I think he uses actually the term banim mashchisim, right? He says we have enough of those. We don't need to bring more into Klal Yisrael.
Right, meaning I think that third argument is if you're going to make someone Jewish, now they have to keep the 613 mitzvot, and they're not in an
Right.
environment where they're going to keep it, you're not
Correct.
doing them a favor because then they're just going
Right.
to be liable for those
Right.
mitzvot.
It's interesting. He doesn't, as far as I saw, it doesn't refer to the term Kabbalas al mitzvos per se. Which obviously is a very touchy and juicy topic in and of itself, but he says even if they were to go through the full gerus, it you're not doing them any favors, exactly as you said.
So would you say these three arguments are more of a halachic argument or of a policy hashkafic kind of argument?
I mean, listen, the I would say that the bracha levatala, I mean, it's a pretty simple argument, right? That's clearly a halachic argument. I don't know, right? It's hard to know where to draw the line between those two areas sometimes. The first one, which is basically his main argument, which is that he doesn't want people to confuse these children later on with as being fully Jewish. I think it's a very valid argument in the sense of, he's afraid it's a halachic slippery slope, but I think a very relevant one, right? That could be very harmful in the future. So
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to surprise me that Rav Illowi takes this more makbid, this hardline stance on the matter. I think you mentioned at the beginning that he was a musmach of the Chasam Sofer. So, we're
right.
talking about Hungarian Judaism, which were known to be hardliners in defense of the tradition. The Chasam Sofer is kind of the
Yeah,
quintessential
yeah.
example of that. And also you mentioned he spoke his mind, which
Yeah.
had a, so this isn't the first time he spoke his mind and took a hardline
Yeah, I
stance
mean,
on the issue.
one of his, kind of main objectives in America was, is this battle against reform, and he has quite a few writings about that.
Right, you does mention that in the I know you gave me this newspaper. Which
Yeah.
I think you're getting to at some point in the Jewish Messenger, which I found very interesting that the if you could speak more about that, because apparently this debate takes place in a newspaper, which is such a funny thing to me because when you think about it, when I read like the Jewish Link or the Jewish Press, these papers, like there might be letters to the editor, like, oh, you
Right.
said something nicer about Israel and war against Hamas or something like that, but usually don't have like halachic policy debates
Correct.
playing in the pages of a typical Jewish. I mean, those are more ad-based papers, maybe, so maybe that's the difference. I'm not sure.
Well, so the truth is, it's a good question you're asking. It's not so unusual for early America to have these really substantive debates going on in the press. So, like I mentioned, Rabbi Illowi doesn't have a book of Shalos and Tshuvos, and neither did some of the other rabbis that were answering questions here in America. So, for example, this who I mentioned, in passing before, Rabbi Rice, the first, musmach, the first ordained rabbi to come here. He also many of his writings are we have them from newspapers, from various periodicals. We don't have them from books of Shalos and Tshuva, so it wasn't so uncommon in early, quote unquote, early American Jewry to Jewish history to find these writings and these debates in the press.
Right, maybe my framework should be it's less the Jewish link, it's more the Times of Israel blog page. That's
Or, you know, to give more of a modern day, you know, maybe parallel, you know, it might be, you know, they didn't have the traditions and the hakiras of the world. So maybe, you know, this is what they had. So this is what they, you know, it was more of like a periodical. Certainly, well, these weren't dailies that came out. You know,
Oh,
they
I see.
maybe came out once a month or so. So, you know,
This
they,
wasn't like, you know,
that's what they
you
printed
could
a lot.
rely on it to be in the back of shul every single Shabbos so you could read
No,
during the family
no.
sermon, right?
Exactly.
But you know, maybe I know we're talking about the newspaper. Could you summarize just what exactly was this debate that took place in the pages of the Jewish Messenger?
So there wasn't much of a debate in the Jewish Messenger. Really, are you referring to the between Rabbi Illui and the other people who wrote to the Jewish Messenger? Because the real debate actually happens later on. Oh, sorry again. The real debate actually takes place later on when Rabbi Illui's opinion is sent to Germany.
So I think even before Germany, just like looking at this newspaper article, I'll just share with you
Yeah.
a few things that stuck out to me. In
Okay,
particular,
go ahead.
the so there's a gentleman, H.I. Almoni, who summarized is like Plony
Yeah.
Almoni, something on that.
I assume so. Yes.
Yeah, so he writes this article summarizing what happened, and
Yeah.
then he takes issue with Dr. Illoway. He calls him Dr. Illoway, which is
Yeah,
also
yeah.
interesting, with Rabbi Dr. Illoway's position. And the editors of the paper actually respond themselves to this op-ed,
Correct.
if you call it. And they say in there that there exists no acknowledged authority to restrain their liberty of action. Outside of his own synagogue, a chazan or rabbi in America is invested with no power whatever beyond expounding the law, which I feel like that's a debate that happens all the time in America in 2023 about does like the Mara D'Asser of a shul have the power to give a psak for his broader community, beyond his community? Does he even have power within
100%.
his own shul to
Yeah,
do
no, it's a great point you're raising. 100%, right? It's times never change, right? So, they weren't taking issue with his position per se, well, with his halachic position, right? They were taking issue with his position, right? With who he was and his authority. Correct. So they said, "Okay, great. That's your opinion basically, but that's where it ends, right?" So yes, right, we have this we don't have state authority in religion in America, right? And so yeah, so that's what they were very much taking taking him to task for. It very much speaks to, and again, this is kind of a theme in American Jewish history in general, it speaks to the democratic ethos, right, and of America and of the United States in general, and how does that carry over, and how does that inform how religion is done, take place, is spoken of? So yeah, no, it's a very important point.
Yeah, what's interesting is to that point, I think we should talk about, as you alluded to, there's this question makes its way all the way to Germany, I believe.
Correct. So this brings us to the next newspaper or periodical where this goes. So Rabbi Illui, who's from again Central Europe and that milieu, right? So he sends his position. He writes to a periodical, an Orthodox periodical in Germany. It was called Die Israelite. I'm sure there's a better pronunciation of that, but the Israelite in English. It was a German periodical put out by a rabbi, Marcus Lehmann, who was a prominent individual in Germany at the time. And he writes about what happened in New Orleans, and he presents his position, and he gets three responses to that, all in support of his position. So one was from Rabbi Lehman himself, the editor. One was from, I'm forgetting the name of the second rabbi, but he was a rabbi, I think, in Dusseldorf. And the third one, which is the most well-known one, is from Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, who's in Berlin. He's the founder of the rabbinical seminary of the Beis Midrash LeRabbanim in Berlin, and highly regarded, not just now, but certainly at the time. And they're all in support of Rabbi Illui's position. So from a historical point, we'll get to the kind of the Rashi Prakim, right? We'll get to the main halachic debate and exchange that takes place as subsequent to this. But this in and of itself is very, very significant, because what happens with Rabbi Illui's psak is that from a historical point of view, it's really the first psak that comes from America and really gets traction in, or beyond America, right, in Europe. Up until then, and this is, you know, part of what I try to figure out and work on is, well, what did Rabbanim and communities outside of America, right, in the Alterheim, what did they think about what was going on religiously in America? How seriously did they take it? So what makes this so significant is that here you have a rabbi from America dealing with an American reality, writing a psak from America, right, in the American press, and the Rabbanim, right, amongst them, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, the posek of German Jewry, is taking it seriously. And so that's what makes this psak so, and this issue, this whole subject, so significant from a historical point of view.
I feel like that was like an important detail they missed in the Frisco Kid. Yeah, I think it was that was it a Mel Brooks movie or something, which was, if you didn't see it, I don't know if you should see it, but it's all that premise of them, the basically the guy who's like the lowest tier rabbi in the seminary, he's a jokester, like, we'll send that guy over to America. So I always wanted to see the sequel, if you had to send any Shilas back to the yeshiva in Europe. But it's basically what you're discussing. It's like fascinating. Like, nowadays on the internet, or we could ask any rabbi, any gadol in the world, and get an answer to it. But this is fascinating to see how American rabbis, had to defer and sometimes send letters across the sea and get answers to rabbis who, only in an abstract sense understood what was happening in America. So let's get the Rashi problem. Let's get the overview. What were the responses? Who agreed? Who disagreed? What were their considerations?
So this turns into, this turns in, right? So it's originally printed in, well, not originally, the European piece of this is originally printed in the Israelite, and then it makes its way to, there are two tshuvos in Shu't Rabbi Azriel, right, which are the tshuvos of Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer, and basically the two tshuvos are an exchange between Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer. As we mentioned, right, he's the posek of German Jewry, lives in Berlin. He's the head of the rabbinical seminary there. A lot to say about him, but we'll save it for another time. It's an exchange between him and Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was also a very prominent rav. He's mostly known nowadays as kind of being this proto-Zionist, this pre-Herzl advocate for the return to Tzion, to Eretz Yisrael. He wrote a famous book called Drishas Tzion on the topic. He was advocating for bringing korbanos nowadays and all kinds of interesting ideas. But aside from that, he was also a very well-known and prominent rav. He wrote Pirushim on Shulchan Aruch and other things. So this becomes, so he reads in the Israelite, Rav Israel Hildesheimer's response and his support of Rabbi Illui. And so he responds to that, taking them to task, and basically disagreeing with their position. So we'll start with Rabbi Kalischer, because that's he. Basically, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer agreed with Rabbi Illui. So there's not, much more to say on that. But the interesting part over here is, well, where did Rabbi Kalischer disagree? With Rabbi Illui's point. So again, just to give some of the main ideas, Rabbi Illui said he was concerned that there would be of circumcising, right, of giving a bris to these children. Rav Kalischer says, he says, and I'll quote for you a few words. He says, "Delo chatas hi rak mitzvah lemulam." Right? He says it's not a sin to give them a bris, but it's actually a mitzvah to give them a bris.
I underlined that one also
Yeah,
when I
right.
saw, I'm like, whoa,
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
quite a
Right. So
response.
where in the world is that coming from? Right? To give a bris to a not to a halachically non-Jewish child, why would that be a mitzvah? So he brings Rayas. He says that Number one, he says, anytime a non-Jew wants to be circumcised, so halakha would dictate, he says, he brings this from Shulchan Aruch, and he brings this from the Rambam, that it's actually a mitzvah that we can go ahead and give them the bris. So that he says, I'm sorry about this. So he says that it's a mitzvah actually, and not only that, but part of perhaps the mitzvah, he says, this is, you know, very universal, I guess, view of Judaism. He says everyone is created by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're all, you know, we're all children to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If only all of us served Hashem in the same way and got closer to Him. So yeah, let's bring them into this. Maybe it's not the bris of Avraham Avinu, but you know, some way of bringing all of humanity, if you will, closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a very interesting take, and certainly reflects a much more universal take on I guess, Judaism and the world, right? So that's one of his points.
Is it very universalist, or is he just wants to turn everyone into Jews, which could be seen as very particular?
So that's possible because Rev, you know, part of Rev Israel's response is, no, we don't really want Gatorim. Right. He says, right, it's like as if Rav Kalischer is saying, yeah, let's like, if somebody wants to take one of the steps towards Geirus, like, why are we going to discourage them? And Rav Israel's like, no, we do discourage them, right? We don't want, right, Kashim Geirim Le Yisrael, etc., quoting all these Gemaras Rav Israel does. And so that's part of the, you know, the point on which they differ.
Right. And so Phil Hildesheimer, you know, even though he's German Jewry, I guess, you know, would you agree that because they were on the forefront of confronting the Reform movement, they felt more of a need to draw a line? Whereas yeah. I'm not sure.
It's possible. I'm not an expert in Rav Israel's Piskei Halacha, you know. So I can't speak more broadly as to his positions, but it's definitely, you know, what you're suggesting may be true 100%. Just to get back to Rav Kalischer's position for a couple of points. So he says, you know, we shouldn't reject the father. The father's coming towards us. Yes, he intermarried. Yes, he did, you know, this terrible thing, but the end of the day, he wants to give a bris to his child. Child's not Jewish, but he wants to give a bris to his child. And a part of bringing and keeping the father closer to Yiddishkeit in some sort of way is you know, embracing him when he wants to take this when he wants to take this step. He kind of sees it as the father at least doing something, some form of tshuva, if you will, even though I don't know if it's going to go beyond that. But the father wants to maintain some sort of connection. You know, it's not necessarily of the child, but of the father over here towards Judaism. So we should embrace the father when he comes to ask us to do this, and we shouldn't reject him.
It's fascinating. So it's like, not, you know, we've been focusing on the nature of the child, but it's almost exactly. Like the child is like this hechi timsa. He's like this means for the father to maintain his
observance. Yeah.
But is it right to put the child through that? If it's, you know, if it's all about his father, that's an interesting, I think, ethical consideration.
Correct. So he says, you know, this is a way of bringing the father, closer. And again, so Rav Israel, you know, basically saying, you know, what is the father, you know, what are we, it's not the father doing tshuva, he intermarried, right? But one point which I do want to raise, I don't know how much time we have left, but in terms of Rav Kalischer's, argument over here is he raises this concept called Zera Kodesh, which is a very touchy, controversial, concept in general, where he says, you know, it's not like we're, you know, even if you were to argue that we shouldn't circumcise a non-Jewish child, but that's with both parents are non-Jewish. Here you have this child whose father is Jewish. There's something holy about this child, even if he's not halakhically, doesn't quite meet the criteria of what it means to be a Jew, but there's something in him, right? There's what he calls Zera Kodesh, and he brings these rayas from the Gemara, which talks about Ezra when they came back to Eretz Yisrael, etc. I know this is a concept which comes up, you know, even today in dealing with, you know, particularly in Israel, with many of the immigrants that came from the former Soviet Union, you know, when a father's Jewish or a grandparent was Jewish, whatever the case may be, right? And they were therefore allowed back into Israel. They were back allowed to make aliyah, but they're not halakhically Jewish. So this concept of Zera Kodesh or Zera Yisrael is something which is brought up and raised a lot. You know, it's certainly something which is relevant to the discussions that take place today. And just to Rav Azriel's response is that's not the definition of Zera Kodesh. You know, that's not what Ezra was faced with. That's not what Ezra was talking about.
And what was the distinction that that
Rav? So I believe that Rav Azriel was saying that. I believe that he's saying when Ezra Sofer was coming back to Eretz Yisrael, it wasn't. Children of intermarried couples that he considered Zera Kodesh, but it was fully Jewish people who somehow got mixed in, and we're just not sure who's who, right? And we kind of lost the knowledge of their lineage. So, but what you, Rav Sphere Scholarster, is defining as Zera Kodesh is not the definition.
Right. That here Ezra they are Vadai. They're certainly from a non-Jewish mother, but there's almost
exactly.
This, it sounds almost like a metaphysical connection to Judaism.
Yeah.
Even if not purely halachic. And if I'm not mistaken, I think different Batei Dinim, when they're vetting people who are applying for conversion, they are on this basis much more amenable to someone who has, you know, at least a Jewish father, rather than just coming more out of the blue.
Yeah.
Wow, fascinating. And I know this is like naturally a very we're talking about this more abstract, and this is naturally a very sensitive topic.
Definitely requires
its own analysis on its own. But so this is fascinating. So like a whole discussion with Rev Ilue in America, a debate within his own community about disqualifying a mohel who's giving a bris to children who are not really Jewish and are not really converting. And even if they are converting, they're not really going to keep the mitzvos. And this winds up becoming a debate in Europe, in Germany as well. So, you know, I feel like this is something that could happen sometimes nowadays. There could be some community, you'll forgive if this sounds pejorative, like in Yehupitzville somewhere, and they say, you know, so-and-so can't be a rabbi, or they make some sort of controversial decision in their shul. Someone gets on Facebook to their audience, and then everyone in the Northeast in New York is in a hullabaloo about what's happening. So this is almost like the pre-internet version of that.
Yeah, I guess it's like, you know, maybe the Israelite was the Facebook of late 19th or mid 19th century Germany. I don't know. But
So remarkable also is that, you know, reading the tshuvas and even the articles in the Jewish Messenger that you sent me, will make it available for listeners, is that even the people who disagree, they articulated themselves. Maybe this is, you know, because they couldn't just write a quick Twitter post about it. They had to submit it to a paper. They had to really think through what they were saying. And they even, maybe this is just like an old fashioned thing. They wrote it in a respectful way. You know, the gentleman from here says such and such, you know, it's kind of when you see them.
It wasn't too long ago when people still did that, you know, prior to the advent of social media, people actually had to write, you know, real substantial things.
right. You couldn't just get published anywhere. You have to really write something of substance.
Yeah, exactly.
And, would you say there are any, you know, I guess two questions. One is, and just in our, like, you know, 3 minutes that we have, are there any, whose side of the argument do you personally find more compelling? And question number two, what would you say are some of the implications for discourse nowadays? I know we already touched on that, but for any unanswered questions or applications.
So, you know, the first question, I don't know. Maybe I'll take the cop out, but you know, to take a position between Rav Azriel Hildesheimer and Sphere Scholarster is a little bit, you know, maybe pretentious of me, but
humility's
I don't know. You know, and again, it might have to do with. The realities that each one of them was facing, like that you were hinting to before, and they really, you know, it does reflect in a way certainly Rav Kalischer is very clearly, advocating some more universal slash just welcoming form of Judaism. That's clearly what he's advocating for. I'm not saying by any stretch that Rav Israel Hildesheimer was not that type of person. And again, I'm not familiar with the whole breadth of his writing to comment on that. But again, I mean, these are the debates. I mean, this, I guess, brings us into the second question, right? I mean, these are exactly the debates that go on nowadays, particularly an issue related to conversion and all of that. I mean, like, probably one of the more hot button issues that are out there is this very question, how welcoming do we want to be? How welcoming do we want to be if it lowers standards, so to speak, of the community in terms of, Shmiras HaMitzvos later on, et cetera? Where do we bring in, what's our responsibility towards people who have this Zera Kodesh, in them, particularly, when it comes to people from the former Soviet Union who lived under, communist, atheistic, regimes for generations, I mean, these are really sensitive and tricky questions. And you see, once part of the real interesting part about studying Jewish history in modern times is that there were no ghetto walls anymore, and all of these interactions really brought these questions to the fore, both in Europe and certainly in America.
Yeah, and I would add, just to your point about these questions being oh so relevant today,
Yeah.
not just when it comes to people who want to convert to Judaism, but even within our own communities. I mean, there's very theoretical. We could debate about the propriety of having an open parking lot, which, of course, in the mid 1900s or so,
Yeah.
Moshe Feinstein and other poskim were really going at it. If I invite someone to shul, and
Yeah.
I very well know they're going to drive. But on the other hand, if we keep the parking lot open, that welcomes more people
Yeah.
in, and maybe
Yeah.
they'll take on more observance. So this is,
Yeah.
you're right. I think this is a great case study in that tension of how to be open and welcoming while also maintaining your principles.
100%.
So Rabbi Zweider, I really want to thank you for your time and for your real expertise that you bring to this. It's such a fascinating way to study Shas and Tshuvos, with the halachic considerations, the historical background. And to our listeners, Rabbi Zweider has a series on Tshuvos in early America.
Still a work in progress, but
Still a work
yeah,
in progress,
there's a
but go
bunch of
on
them up there.
YuTorah.
Yeah,
And where else
thank
can
you.
people find your work? Where should people be looking?
There's a couple of articles if they Google, my name, they should come up. A few articles that I've written, these are subjects that fascinate me. So I really thank you for the opportunity to be able to share some of this with you and your audience.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and thank you to all the listeners for joining us today.
All right, thank
Until
you.
next time, Rabbi Zweider,
All
Shkoyach.
right, be well. Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Take care. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.